Old Germans, romance, with a life of the mind. I had a proper English breakfast with sausage, grilled tomatoes and mushrooms, beans, Canadian bacon, and fried toast. I ate, even though I wasn't hungry, while reading through glasses that did nothing for my eyesight. At 2:15, a hale-looking white man came in. He was my age, wearing a light gray suit. He sat three tables away from me and ordered coffee. At 2:45 exactly, Inspector Natchez walked in, wearing a dark blue suit. He was both bulky and tall. Though he was 20 years my senior, I was sure that he had some fight left in his sinews. He said a word to the hostess, and she led him to my table. He stood over me a moment or two, staring intently. He knew who I was. He might not have pierced the disguise, but Congressman Acres' message was a clear proclamation. "Have a seat," I said. He hesitated, but sat. "I don't know who the fuck you think you are, but this little game of yours is not going to work." "Tea?" "No, I don't want any fucking tea," he said, a few decibels above the proper volume.
People around turned their heads.
Natchez's brows furrowed.
The waitress came with the pre-ordered platter of sandwiches and pastries.
"What kind of tea would you like?"
she asked Natchez.
"Whatever," he said, at least keeping his voice down. "I'll have Irish breakfast," I said.
"We only have English breakfast."
"Then that'll have to do."
We waited for the service, Natchez fuming, and me feeling like a cop again. After the woman, who was straw-haired, 40s, and quite comfortable with her body, poured our tea and retreated, Natchez sat up straight. The man in the gray suit sat up also. The tinkling bell at the top of the front door sounded, and Mel walked in. He wore black trousers and a herringbone sports jacket. He took the lay of the restaurant and asked for a table quite close to the gunsel in gray.
"Look, man," I said to Natchez, "I've been beaten, scarred, disgraced, imprisoned, and had my marriage torn apart by you motherfuckers without even a word of explanation or warning. People have tried to murder me, and you sit there on your ass like your boss Tweed or something. Understand me. You are not safe."
"You think I'm scared of you? You think just because you can string a sentence together that I'm going to make you a police again? I wouldn't have a half-assed disgraced cop like you shine my shoes. I sure the fuck will not kiss your feet."
He was angry. Maybe, like the short cuckold on Staten Island, he was always angry. But I believed this passion was anchored in fear.
"If that's true," I said, "then why are you here?"
It was an honest question, and how he answered would inform my next moves.
"Don't fuck with me," he said.
"The fact that you're sitting in front of me with a bodyguard a few tables away means I'm already fucking with you, brother. What I want to know is why Paul Convert framed my ass. What I want to know is why you motherfuckers tried to murder me. Twice." The inspector's hazel eyes were suddenly filled with questions and revelations.
"You're crazy," he said, in a voice that was trying desperately to take the higher ground.
"Why go through all this shit?" I asked. "I mean, okay, 10, 12 years ago, I was on a case. I might have been bullheaded and tried to take down whatever you had going on the docks. You felt that you had to stop me. I could see that. But now that I know the game and the players, why don't you just let me back in?" Asking these questions, I realized that this was what was most important to me. Keeping me in the dark, maybe even putting me in the grave, was what was most important to Natchez. I looked up and noticed that Mel had gotten to his feet. He walked over to Natchez's gray guardian and took the seat across from him.
"You don't know a thing,"
Dennis Natchez said to me.
"A little man like you could go out like a candle sitting on the windowsill. We should have taken care of you back then, when you were a cowboy."
"Why didn't you?" The answer was in his eye, but it wouldn't make it to his lips.
"I'm finished with you,"
Natchez said. He pushed his chair back from the table.
"You should finish your tea," I said.
You're dead, and don't know it, he said with a grin that couldn't help but be evil.
You mean like your friend over there does?
Natchez glanced over and saw smiling Melquoth Frost and his own man looking both serious and defeated. I learned a lot since I was a police detective, thinking he could do it on his own, I said.
I learned that reading is important, that law is an ever-changing variable equation, and that a man is a fool if he works alone.
Natchez settled back into his chair. I learned that anyone can be brought low, no matter how high or powerful they are. I know that if I die, you will too. You should know that, Dennis. Your man over there with my man's gun on him should know that. Now get your ass out of here, and remember that your heart can stop beating too. He took his time, standing from the chair. I looked over to see that the bodyguard was also on his feet. They both tried to intimidate us with their stares, but we knew that two cops couldn't open fire in a New York place of business, and they couldn't trust that we wouldn't. After all, there was already one dead man across the river in Queens. When Natchez and his man were gone, Mel got up and sauntered over to me. I told the straw-headed Zoftig waitress to bring the bills for Mel and the bodyguard to me. You think they're laying for us out there? I asked Mel when the waitress went away to do my bidding. I hope not, he said. For them. But it doesn't matter anyway. Why not?
The reason I chose this place is that it has a little-known exit to the building next door, and that building has an exit on the alley behind. But even if that wasn't true, I got three guys outside with all kinds of firepower. I sent them photos with my cell phone, and they're the kind of guys that know when an ambush is set up.
I smiled and told him about the conversation.
He's already in somebody's crosshairs, Mel pronounced.
But who?
Mel's cell phone sounded.
Yeah?
He answered. Then, all right, thanks. He put away the phone and said to me, nobody's out there. The inspector and his man left in the same car. I picked up a crustless cucumber sandwich and took a nibble.
You got a place to stay, King?
Storage unit in the West Village.
Huh.
Look, Mel, I appreciate your help, but right now, I'm going to look into some stuff. I'll call you later on, and maybe, if you got the time, you could help me again.
You sure the fuck need it.
26. There's a beautiful high-rise apartment building on 42nd Street, a block or so east of 10th Avenue. It's constructed from plate glass and steel girders with a 30-foot-high atrium for an entrance.
May I help you, sir?
A caramel-colored, red-jacketed man asked. He was standing behind a 4.5-foot high green marble counter.
Miranda Goya, I said, happy to have at least one sentinel treat me with decorum.
He picked up a phone receiver, but before bringing it to his ear, he said,
your name?
Joe Oliver. Making all the right moves, the man said into the phone,
a Mr. Oliver for you, Miss Goya.
He was younger than I by at least 5 years and had generous lips that were exactly the same tone as the rest of his skin. This unusual aspect gave the guardian a kind of specialized, almost synthetic, air.
2813, he said to me. Thank you.
The elevator was large, and my only companion was a woman, probably in her 80s, who had mastered makeup well enough to take at least 15 years off her appearance. She had a small black-and-white dog on a leash that was straining to get at me. I like dogs. If some evolutionist had told me that men had descended from canines, I would have believed her. All the brotherly passion, fang-bearing hunt lust, and fear I feel on a daily basis, I see in dogs. I was a dog. I'd been told that my entire life. By men and women alike.
I can't let him greet you,
the lady said. She was wearing a fox wrap over an emerald cashmere sweater.
He bites?
Pisses. He pisses on any man's foot that gets close enough. He's a bad boyfriend, but I love him.
I nodded and felt real empathy.
You in a new play?
She asked then. What?
The mustache, she said. And those silly sideburns.
How can you tell?
This is an actor's co-op,
she explained.
Everyone here knows makeup, camera shots, and about 100,000 lines of bad writing.
Just came from a dress rehearsal at BAM, I said. A play we're debuting in Cincinnati. Right now, I'm going to run some lines for another project.
With who?
I tell you, but I don't think her husband would like it. The older lady with the dead fox around her neck smiled and bowed her head ever so slightly. Dog Lady got off at the 14th floor, and I traveled alone to 28. I walked halfway down the hall of doors to my left and pressed the button on the jamb of 2813. There was no faraway sound of a bell or buzzer, but I didn't want to seem impatient and so refrained from following up with a knock.
Who is it?
Came a woman's voice.
Joe Oliver. You don't look like him.
I wondered if Lamont had somehow taken a cell phone picture of me or if he just told her what I looked like. I put on a mustache and shaved the head because I didn't want anybody recognizing me on the case. I could call Mr. Charles at the Aramaya if you want. After a brief pause, she pulled the door open. Miranda Goya was one of the most beautiful women I, or the dog in me, had ever seen. She was in her late 20s, but had the stance of a veteran. Her knee-length dress was composed of equal swirls of purple, red, and green. Her figure denied the garment, and, I was sure, had betrayed her again and again from the age of 13. Her face was heart-shaped and haughty. The blended color of ethereal rose gold and earthbound bronze informed her skin. I crossed the threshold, and she moved to the side. She bit her lower lip as I took off the bulky coat.
That coat makes you look fat.
Thank God for small blessings.
Go on in,
she offered. It was a small studio with a diaphragm-high wall separating the kitchen from the living room. The wall was mounted by a flat, 2-foot-wide formica-covered plank that was both her dining room and desk. A glass double door formed her outer wall. This led to a tiny terrace that looked north toward Harlem. Next to the glass door was a huge bird of paradise in a 10-gallon clay pot, sporting 11 of the gorgeous orange and blue blossoms.
Mr. Oliver, she said.
Yes.
Is that your real name?
Yes, it is. I took out my wallet and handed her my PI's license. She took the laminated card and compared it to the bald man standing before her.
This looks like the man Lamb told me about, she said. What do you want with me?
I'm looking into the defense of a free man, I said. And ever since then, people been on me. I decided that if I looked different, maybe I'd get a little deeper without getting shot. Miranda took a deep breath and pursed her lips to express her empathy.
Have a seat, Mr. Oliver, she said.
There were two padded wicker chairs facing each other right at the veranda door. Between them was a green glass box that stood in as a table. I sat and she asked,
Whiskey?
Scotch or bourbon?
Sour mash,
she said with a pleasing sneer. Darling, you have just become the favorite person of my day. The laugh didn't make it as far as her throat, but it was real mirth from a dark place. From the kitchen, she said,
Ice?
No, thank you. When she sat down across from me, I started to think about Asia. My daughter was a beautiful woman with curves and class and a smile that made you happy. This trick worked. My heart slowed down and I emptied the generous dram of whiskey.
You want another one?
Miranda asked. Yes, I do. But no, I won't. That smile etched her lips.
Lamb said that he thought you might be all right,
she shared.
That's unusual. Every time somebody come talk to him about Manny, he calls me from a payphone and tells me what they look like and when they were there. Lamb don't talk about Manny to just anybody, especially if that anybody is a cop. Ex-cop, I corrected. Once a cop, always a cop. I laughed and felt the whiskey spreading mildly over my brow.
Okay, Mr. Ex-cop, Miranda said. What did you want to talk to me about?
A free man. What do you want to know? I have heard that there was a conspiracy against him and all the Blood Brothers, and there are still people working to make sure his story is silenced. The beautiful woman looked toward the window. She turned back to me and said, Your mustache is coming loose. Up on the left side? Not that much right now, but people will be able to tell after a while. I touched the side she mentioned and felt the looseness.
You want me to touch it up?
She asked. Say what?
That's what I do. I'm a makeup artist. After Manny freed me, the Blood Brothers asked me what I wanted to do and sent me to school.
Without further discussion, she went to a closet near the front door, pulling out what looked like a fisherman's box and a collapsible stool. She sat up in front and to the right of me, putting the box on the green glass coffee table.
Move your hair back.
I did, and she studied the false hairs.
Somebody did a pretty good job of this. Your girlfriend?
I explained the class I took and the reason I took it.
That's really smart for a straight man, Miranda said. You know, most men only know about tits and ass. They couldn't even tell you the color of somebody's eyes.
Detectives do it for a living.
What you want to know about Manny?
She asked, as she went to work on the semi-detached lip hair. Lamont says that Mr. Mann pulled you out of a bad situation.
Not only me.
I'm talking to you, though.
Yeah.
She dabbed a strong-smelling ointment across the top of the mustache.
I was deep in it, and one day Manny walked in a room and took me out. That was it.
I was slowly becoming a reluctant fan of Leonard Compton, free man.
And it wasn't just me, she repeated. There was 100 children at any one time doing all kinds of shit for them.
Who? She had to take a breath before saying.
Valance and Pratt.
Were there others? I mean, others working with them?
Yeah, but I didn't know their names.
Policemen?
I don't really know.
She concentrated on the hairs a little more and said,
They had this piece of paper with a price list for 67 things we had to do if they paid for it. Nasty things. Anything.
So they were full-out pimps, and Mr. Mann took you away from that, I said.
Not only pimps, they killed people too. Murdered them.
You mean the Blood Brothers?
Them? Kids tried to run, and family wanted to free him, and anybody got in their way.
These murders are on record. Miranda pressed against my whole upper lip with at least 6 fingers. Then she sat back in her chair. She took in a deep breath and watched me with eyes that, like her skin, were not quite brown. After maybe 3 minutes, she said,
You know, I love Lamont. He treated me like a real woman and never even once tried to take advantage. You know, a girl like me make men want to take advantage, and we hardly even know it. I love Lamont, and I can't even tell you how much I feel about Manny. I was in the back room of a massage parlor on 39th with this white man, got his fist up my ass, felt like all the way to his forearm, and a free man come in with a gun. Shit. That white man messed himself and ran like some kind of dog. And nobody has done nothing to me I ain't said yes to since that night. Now Manny's up on death row, and I can't do a damn thing to help him. He won't even let me come visit, because he don't want me to get in trouble. All that, and I'm still scared shit to talk to you.
My temporary phone beeped, and I took it out. Mel had texted me a name and an address. Thanks for the cosmetic work, I said. How much I owe you?
You don't owe me nothing. I offered.
I stood up and said, Thanks for your help, Miss Goya. I'm sorry to bring up such painful memories.
That's it?
She said. Yeah. I want to try and prove the things you said, but I can't promise that someone might not figure out if you told me things that nobody else knows. I never met Mr. Mann, but I don't think he'd appreciate me trading your life for his. Her eyes opened wide as if she'd remembered something.
Burns, she said.
Huh?
He was with me that day. Manny busted in. Manny took him out of there, too.
His name is Burns?
They call him that, but his real name is Theodore.
Why they call him Burns?
He had a client like to burn him after every time they fucked. And he fucked Theodore once a week. He got all these scars on his face and left arm.
I'm pretty sure that that was the turning point for me. It might have been what Miranda had experienced in the massage parlor. Maybe if I had not heard what happened to her there, I could have overlooked Theodore's experience. I don't know. But from that moment on, I wasn't merely solving one case or another. I was as serious as a slave who said no more to his chains. What about Theodore?
Before Manny got us, he used to work with Valance and Pratt pretty close. I mean, they had him fucking people too, but sometimes he helped them with the heavy lifting.
Can you tell me anything else about him? I asked. A last name?
He only goes by Burns.
Anything else I should know?
He's on heroin,
the beauty said with an ugly sneer.
He don't want to give it up. He says the only way he stays alive is to be high.
You try to get him some help? I asked. I don't know why. No, she said, flat and low. Why not?
'Cause he right, she said,
her tone a dialect sliding all the way back to that massage parlor.
Getting straight would kill him for sure.
27. Leaving the Actors' Co-op, my head was as light as a helium balloon, with feet that were forged from lead. There was an abscess of evil out in the world, and for some reason, that was my responsibility, if not my fault. A free man was on death row. No cop, judge, or average Joe was going to put up their hand and say, "I have a doubt." Before that afternoon, I'd often wondered how men and women became traitors. How could they one day wake up and say, "Everything I believed was wrong, and now they have to pay." I never even considered for one moment that Miranda Goya was lying. Me, a man who didn't even trust his own clients, a man who had experienced betrayal on almost every level. I walked down to Port Authority and stood on the corner of 42nd and 8th, trying to feel my way back to Montague Street and its mild indictments of big business and human nature. I wanted the worst problem to be my daughter's choice of dresses or some traumatized white man thinking that I was abusing A.D.
"You okay, sir?"
someone asked. The words were friendly, but the tone was not. It was a beat cop who patrolled the sidewalks surrounding the giant bus station. I didn't recognize him. I did wonder how he picked me out of all the junkies, pickpockets, prostitutes, and runaways. "Yes, I am, officer," I said. "It's just that I had to stop a minute and put my head together." "Can you walk?" the shorter, white cop asked. I smiled, nodded, and then moved away from the big building that made humanity seem like the last dying colony of prehistoric ants. I could have taken the subway, but instead I walked up to 8th and 73rd. Down 73rd, about half a block, stood a seven-story brownstone apartment building that was very old. I climbed the stoop, pulled open the outer door, and then searched the list of names for Thurman Hodge. I pressed the button for 27, Thurman's designation, and waited.
"Who is it?"
a gravelly voice asked over a staticky intercom connection.
"Smith," I replied. The address and the names Thurman and Smith were all sent by text to me by Melquoth. The fact that I was there meant that I had abandoned and very possibly betrayed the world I'd known.
"Be right down,"
the rough voice told me. The vestibule smelled of mold. Some people might have been put off by the odor, but for me it was a pleasant reminder of the apartment building where I lived with my mother, brother, and sister after our father was sentenced and before I was old enough to run away.
"Yeah,"
a man said from the other side of the apartment building's windowed door. He was 5'8" in shoes, with coarse salt-and-pepper hair that he brushed equally to either side. Wearing a paint-stained, once-white artist's smock, it looked like some villain from Dick Tracy in the old newspaper comic strips. flat top, or maybe because of his scowl. Gruesome? I'm here for the bargain basement, I told the beady-eyed comic strip villain. He squinted a little harder, and then opened the door.
Follow me,
he said. We walked down a slender corridor to a flight of three steps, out a door that led to an especially small courtyard, and across the yard to another door. While Hodge, if that was his name, searched a large keychain, he said,
You can tell Moran that this is the last time I can rent the place. The owners want to put some kind of IT center down here, and ain't nothing I can do about that.
I had no idea who Moran was, but Mr. Hodge didn't need to know that. He found the key and worked it on the lichen-crusted, white enamel-painted door. He gestured for me to walk in and turned on the light after I realized that there was a series of stairs leading down. I stumbled only slightly, but was reminded of the day before when, on a similar set of stairs, I shot a man in the head. 15 steps down, I found myself in another cellar. This one had been transformed into a studio apartment designed for men and women on the run. This reminded me of Mel's connection to the Underground Railroad, made me think that I was fighting a war beyond the laws that once claimed my allegiance.
No TV or radio reception down here,
the man who might have been named Hodge said.
The hot plate works, but there's no good ventilation, so don't cook anything you don't want to smell for the next few days. The space heater works, and here's the keys for the apartment and the front door. There's a bell for the super up front, but don't call her. It's me you deal with.
I nodded and handed Mr. Hodge one of the $100 bills that Antrobus's purple-garbed goon had given me. Hodge took the tip with an expression of surprise.
Anything you need, he said. Just ring.
Do you get cell phone reception down here? I asked, before he could depart.
Not unless Jesus Christ gave you the phone.
Two blocks away, I found a coffee shop that served glazed meatloaf and sour mash. I got the taste for the whiskey at Miranda's apartment and wanted to follow it down a ways. Hello? Andre Turneau said. Hey, brother. Joe, how are you? Feel like I went to sleep on the ground and woke up in a coffin.
I get that way every time I go home to Port-au-Prince. What can I do for you, my friend?
Call Henri and tell him to call this number from a payphone.
You're not going to get my boy in trouble now, are you, Joe?
I remember why you bought that pistol, Mr. Turneau. Don't you worry about that. The meatloaf tasted better with every sip of whiskey. I was feeling almost jocular when the cell phone sounded. Hello?
Joe,
Henri Turneau said.
You still hiding?
I called Natchez.
And what did he have to say?
I told him as much as was necessary and added, I think you might be able to figure out our connection, so I wanted to ask if you had some friend who could look up a street name for me.
Anything, Uncle.
The familial endearment touched me. I don't think it was just the whiskey. The days I followed down my expulsion from the police and the man conviction, I was also learning that I had a multifaceted life with many planes of beauty to it. An hour later, I received a text that said a junkie called Burns was a regular at the Bread and Bees homeless shelter on Avenue C in the East Village. When I got that message, I was already on 7th Avenue at Christopher in the West Village. There I was waiting outside a nameless fortune-telling parlor. Through the glass wall facade was a shallow room done all in reds. There were various crystals and two plush chairs, a calico cat, and the framed photograph of a large-nosed man with a receding hairline. I walked in and was assailed by a sweet brand of incense that I recognized but could not name. The electronic announcement of my entrance was the sound of a solitary lark calling out for an old friend or a new love. Through red curtains came a plump woman with pale skin, dressed in a green wraparound that was festooned with tiny round mirrors.
Yes?
She asked.
Lackey, I said. The woman's face didn't have far to go for the glower she gave me.
Tell him it's Seamus from the south side. She sneered, but went back through the curtains. I waited there, wondering what kind of prison time I could expect after I'd finished with my investigations. The woman opened the curtains without entering the spiritual consultation room, saying,
Come.
We passed through a short, dark hall into a bright kitchen, where two women and three children were either cooking or eating. One dirty-faced little girl looked up from the dining table, smiled, and stuck her finger in her nose. The frowning woman took me through another door into what I could only call a sitting room. There were two stuffed chairs therein. One was yellow with big dark blue polka dots. It was of normal dimensions and looked quite comfortable. The other chair was twice the size of its little sister and might have been black. I couldn't make out the full design or color because they were obstructed by the impossibly fat man who sat there. Kieran Klasky weighed well north of 400 pounds. He could have willed his face to be sewn into a basketball after he died. It was that large and round. The features of his physiognomy were mostly just fat, as were his bloated hands and ham-round thighs. Kieran was a white man in a blue suit wearing a red tie. There was a black Stetson on the table next to his sofa-sized chair. I wondered if he ever donned the hat and stood up.
"Joe!" he bellowed.
"Kieran,
I heard you got fired."
"That was 11 years ago."
"I'm still here,"
he said.
"What do you need?"
Back before my dismissal from the force, I saved Kieran from a bust that would have put him away for years. He had information I needed about the heroin connection at the Brooklyn docks, and I got a friend in records to taint his most recent arrest report. "Can I sit?" I asked the fat man.
"Please do,"
he said, and gestured.
"Maria!"
A woman blundered gracelessly into the room. She was young and wearing a peasant dress that might be found anywhere in Eastern Europe a century ago. It was made from strips of differing fabrics dyed in bold colors. Her face was both beautiful and haunted.
"Yes, Papa,"
she said.
"Bring our guest, Grappa."
"Yes, Papa,"
she said, and then lurched away.
"She's a beautiful thing,"
Kieran said.
"But her mind is always somewhere else."
"Looks like she doesn't need to pay attention," I said.
"Why are you here, Joe?"
He was older than I, but in our business, age hardly mattered. I was his inside asset for 3 months when he really needed it. "Do you know a junkie named Burns?" Maria came back carrying a delicate water glass, three-quarters filled with clear, 110-proof liquor. She waited for me to take a sip. When I didn't gag, she smiled and left.
"First or last name?"
Kieran asked. "Nickname. They call him that because he has burn scars on his face and left arm."
"Oh, him. Yes, a very troubled young man. Do you need to find him?"
"I can do that on my own. I just wanted to know anything you could tell me."
"He's a good customer when he's got money. Must have found a new connection, though. I haven't seen him in months. Maybe he's dead."
"What's his habit?"
"Used to get two hits at a time. For a while there, I was seeing him three times a day."
"Two at a time?" He nodded.
"Then that's what I need you to sell me."
Bread and Bees Homeless Shelter got its name from the beehives Arnold Frey kept on top of the building. He used the honey to feed his homeless, wino, and addict population.
"Honey," Arnold would say, "is the food of God."
When Arnold died, his daughter, Hester, took over management of the retreat. She was big like her father and tough like him, too. She maintained the apiary and baked the bread. I strolled up to the desk of the men's shelter and said, "Hi, my name is Joe Oliver."
"The cop?"
Hester asked, standing up from her walnut office chair. "Last time I saw you, you couldn't have been more than 16, I said, "and I don't look anything like I did."
"I got a long memory," she said. "You need it in this calling."
She wore a long black dress that completely hid any figure she might have had. "What else you remember about me?"
"All I need to know is that you're a cop."
"Not anymore. I was fired more than a decade ago." Her smile was unbidden. "I came to see if I could find a guy called Burns," I said.
"And you expect me to help you?"
Her eyes were gray and I knew mine were brown. We studied each other, looking for a reason to trust, but there was nothing there. "I'll promise you that I have no evil designs on Theodore, and on top of that, I'll donate $1,000 to the shelter in cash right now. I'll agree to meet him under your supervision, too. 28. After the financial transaction, Hester summoned a wraith-like young black man to lead me to a shed up on the roof near the beehives. He had gray eyes like hers. The shanty shack's door was secured by a padlock. After the impossibly thin young man had used his key, I asked, "What's your name?"
"Mikey."
"Give me the lock, Mikey." He did so, and I attached it to the eye of the latch so that the door would have to remain unlocked. "I'll take the key, too." He almost balked, but then acquiesced. Inside, he found the pull chain that flooded the one-room workshed with at least 400 watts of yellow light from a single bulb.
"She'll be up in a while,"
he said, looking everywhere but at me. I called Mikey a black man because that's the term I use for people who come from our so-called race. But he was actually a shade of gray that was tending toward black, where his eyes were a similar shade headed in the opposite direction. He turned away, leading with his shoulders, and left me to the chilly shack. I had Steppenwolf in my overcoat pocket, but before I could take it out, I spied an old textbook of first-year Latin on the cluttered work table. All around the old russet-colored hardback were tools that had to do with bees and their honey. Reading the editor's introduction to the book, which had been published in 1932, I learned that there had been something called the General Report of the Classical Investigation. This university study had recommended a new way for learning the ancient language, a way that took a historical and also a cultural approach. I skimmed through the author's preface, then delved into the meat of the book. I had just learned that Virgil called his countrymen Gens Togata, which meant toga-clad people, when the unlocked door swung open and black-clad Hester walked in. She was followed by another slender man of color who wore a yellow and green sports jacket, stiff jeans, and no shirt at all.
"Theodore," Hester said, "I'd like you to meet Mr. Joe King Oliver."
The fact that she knew my middle name was truly a shock.
"Hey,"
the man I would always think of as Burns said. I closed the book, stood, and took his proffered hand. His face was a deep brown, but all along the left side there were craters and calloused, scarred skin. His left hand was also mutilated and defaced. The skin was scabrous and scaly. While I studied the details of his disfigurement, he stared at me. I was sure he couldn't see my scar, but somehow I believed that he intuited it.
"Mr. Oliver wants to ask you some questions," Hester said.
"Have a seat," I said to both the young man and his chaperone. The work table was against an unpainted pine wall, and there were 5 backless stools along it. We each took a stool. Hester was staring at me, prepared at any moment to end the interview. Burns was the epitome of what I understood to be a junkie. He was afraid of me, but at the same time wondering if there might be a profit in our interaction. He was always looking for the next fix. Maybe he could smell the packets I scored from Kieran.
"It's good to meet you, Theodore," I said.
"You too,"
he nodded. "Miranda told me to tell you hello."
"You know me?"
"I met with Lamont out on Coney Island, and he sent me to her. She told me her story and said I might want to talk to you."
"Mia didn't know I was here,"
Theodore said with suspicion. Hester swiveled her shoulders as if she were about to pronounce judgment. "She told me you used, so I asked a friend on the force to look up your nickname along with Theodore. They knew you came here sometimes."
"All the time," Hester said. "He's trying to get his head together." "Why you go from Lamont to Mir to me?"
Burns asked. "Because I was hired to prove that a free man was hunted and conspired against by members of the NYPD, specifically Officers Valance and Pratt." Both Burns and Hester had the same frown on their faces.
"Manny?"
said Burns. I nodded.
"What does Theodore have to do with that?"
Hester asked. "I have no idea," I said truthfully. "I talked to Miranda, and she pointed me here."
"Like a gun,"
Hester said to Burns. But he wasn't listening. You want to help Manny? He asked me. It seemed as if he saw something important and lasting in the intention alone, like a burning bush or a resurrection.
That's what I've been hired to do.
Hired by who? Hester asked. The burned man's eyes echoed the question.
Nobody official, I allowed. I'm not working for the cops or the state, and the person paying me really wants Mr. Mann to be released. But I can't give you a name. That would violate client confidentiality.
How do we know you're not lying? Hester asked.
You don't, I admitted. But I paid the shelter the money for this meeting, and you don't know anything about the case. There was an agenda to my answer. If Burns knew that I had money to pay for information, he was more likely to want to deal with me.
This meeting is over, Hester said, but she was already too late.
No, Burns interjected.
No, I believe him. I know why Miranda sent him here.
Hester's shoulders sagged then.
She knew Theodore. She knew that he knew that I had what he needed.
I remembered something that my grandmother would say. You can't protect a wolf from being a wolf.
That's like trying to say it's midnight when it's really high noon.
We should probably talk alone, I said to Burns.
No,
Hester proclaimed.
Yeah, we should, Auntie H,
Burns said, a note of authority in his voice.
You don't want to know nothing about what got to do with Manny and them cops.
You can't do this, Hester said to me. I stood up from my stool. Burns followed suit.
I'll give you the money back,
Hester offered, realizing too late that her greed for the shelter was, in its own way, a betrayal. I'll bring him back tonight, I said.
You'll get him killed.
He's no use to anyone as a witness, Miss Frey, and I won't tell about our conversation if you don't.
He's vulnerable,
she said in a whisper.
Vulnerable.
With that one word, she was able to explain the pain of his prostitution and the need for self-destruction. His addiction, coupled with the inability to escape any part of the suffering rained down upon him by a life not of his making. There were hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of young people like Burns stumbling down the streets of rural, suburban, and big city America. They each had the same affliction, but they could only be saved one at a time.
No, I'm not, Auntie Hester, the scarred man intoned. Not even a captain in the Green Berets could survive one day in the life I got to live. I'm strong. I could take it.
Hester Frey was defeated by this claim. I could see in her eyes that she was in love with her job and her people. This passion made me want to know more about her. But there was no time for that kind of recreation.
I got to score before we do anything else,
Burns told me on the street.
I got what you need, I said.
What?
Kieran sold me 2 hits, I said. He said 2 was your base buy, so I got 1 to cut the pain, but at the same time keep you able to talk. I'll give you it right now. After we talk, I'll give you the other and $200.
Kieran from up in Harlem?
Burns asked. He delivered the question as a foregone conclusion, telling me that he was a canny junkie whom I had to be careful with.
You and I both know he works for the gypsy in the West Village.
Let's see what he give you.
Is there somewhere we could go?
Burns's grin was missing a brown tooth or two, but there was still mirth and real satisfaction there. We went east a couple of blocks, crossed a concrete park, and entered a street I'd never been on. I called it a street, but it was closer to being an alley. Halfway down that block was a 3.5-foot space between 2 nondescript buildings blocked by a padlocked dumpster. Burns and I pushed the can aside and made our way maybe 15 feet when we came to a door that looked to be locked too, but was not. On the other side of the door was a chamber no more than 6 foot square. I could see this because there was a small light bulb dangling from a socket overhead that Burns turned on by twisting it. It wasn't inside, but then again it was walled off and roofed away from the outside. The floor was asphalt. The only furniture was a 3-legged wooden stool. There was no trash or garbage on the ground. As a matter of fact, there was an old broom leaning in a corner that had seen quite some use.
What is this?
I asked my informant while taking the wallet from my pocket and the heroin from there. Burns took the little fold of cellophane and studied it carefully.
That's Kieran, all right, he mumbled. He stepped on this shit himself.
It felt odd that we shared knowledge.
What is this place? I asked again.
You ever hear of Joaquin De Palma?
Yeah. De Palma was a socialite addict who would give wild parties for like-minded people of all classes. He was slippery and dangerous, attracting artists, musicians, and debutantes to his cause. He was finally murdered by a man named Tibor, whose daughter had OD'd at one of De Palma's raves.
I used to hang with him. This is his place he'd go when he just wanted to get high and be alone. And then, when he died, it was mine alone.
While talking, Burns put together his fix. He sat down on the stool, filled the spoon, cooked the H with water from a bottle in his pocket, and used the simple hypodermic attached to a red rubber bulb. The seclusion, dim light, and ascetic nature of the room made his actions seem holy.
I was hoping he didn't die.
For one very long minute after the injection, Burns stared at the ground. Then he looked up at me.
I could use another one.
And so you shall have, I promised.
But first, we have to talk.
I like coffee after my fix, he said,
reminding me of a much older man. 29. It was maybe 8 blocks from the unique shooting gallery to Cafe Chino Caprice on Lafayette. The coffee shop was open 23 hours a day, at least that's what the sign said. It was late enough that the place wasn't completely crowded. We settled at a round corner table with our 2 paper cups of black coffee, which cost $2.95 each, plus tax. Burns was breathing easily, only sipping at the coffee now and then.
Kieran's shit sets down hard and keeps it going for a good long time, Burns said. If I had 2 hits, I'd be well till lunchtime tomorrow.
Miss Goya says that you can help me exonerate Mr.
I thought you wanted to get him off death row.
Not execute, I explained. Exonerate.
Prove he's innocent.
Oh,
Burns snickered.
I know a lot of words, but sometimes I get a little mixed up because I ain't never been to school. Not really. I was in elementary school for 8 years, but then when I just couldn't graduate and I was 14, they sent me on my way. My mom's was already dead, and I only went because she wanted me to, but then she died, and they let me go. My mom's was a nurse one time, and she loved roses.
I wondered if he was playing me. I need you to concentrate on what happened to man, I said.
Yeah, he said. I could x-ray him for you. I mean, I know what happened. And what they planned.
Who?
Valance and Pratt.
You knew them pretty well?
Pretty well? I had to suck Pratt's scrawny dick at least once a week. He would tell me every time that if I told Valance that he'd kill me. He'd hold a gun to my head while I was sucking him. I was always afraid he'd bust a nut and pull the trigger at the same time.
I thought Miranda said that man took you out from them.
He did. 3 times. But you know, I had that junk in my veins, and everything that the brothers have on me needed you to be straight. I tried. I really tried. I really did. But you know, being high is the only way things make sense in my head. Valance and Pratt knew that. They knew how to keep me right.
I don't think the courts would take something like that as evidence, I said.
No, they wouldn't. No one takes a junkie seriously. Even if I told them I was the one set up Manny for getting killed, they wouldn't believe it.
You set up a free man for Valance and Pratt?
When Burns looked up at me, there was a smile on his face and tears streaming from his eyes.
Them cops come to me and say that Manny was getting in their business too bad and that they needed to talk to him. That was a code. They knew I didn't want to hurt nobody, and so they say talk
when they meant kill. I was sitting right in front of him, but he was looking to the right at a blank wall.
You did this for them more than once? I asked.
They said they wanted to talk to Manny,
Burns continued, ignoring the question.
They said they'd give me $100 and I'd be free of them if I tell Manny I had dirt on them and to meet me at the Seagate Pier down on the West Village side. I made them give me $100 up front, and then I called Manny and said exactly what they wanted me to.
Did you go there too?
No. I was at Auntie Hester's, sleeping in that same shed where I met you.
So you're the one who set up Mr. Mann for the ambush in the West Village?
Yeah. Out near the crypt.
There's no crypt around over there, I said, realizing that I was beginning to talk like the junkie.
Not no tourist trap fake plaque saying that this was where they buried George Washington or nothing like that. But you better believe there's a sure enough graveyard just a couple blocks from where Yolo and Anton had me lead Manny.
And you just told him to meet you, even though you knew they planned to kill him? Burns turned his head to face me. His eyes were still crying, while the smile had subsided into a wry grin.
Yeah.
And you say you did this more than once?
A few times they had me steer people their way, and once I had to help him carry Maurice Chapman down there.
Show me. It was a long walk for the junkie, but he made it in his own fashion. At times he'd stagger, and now and then he came to a complete halt. He didn't talk much. I got the feeling that this mission was more serious than just the one hit of H could handle. There was an abandoned church a block north of Christopher on the West Side Highway. This made me think of Mel and the evil where only good was supposed to exist. There was a metal door behind a stand of holly at the north wall of the defunct House of Prayer.
See that brick with the black spot over the door?
Burns asked.
Yeah.
Reach up and pull that sucker out.
The iron door was tall and wide. I could barely reach, but finally managed to tease out the loose stone. On the inside plane of the brick, there was taped a sophisticated key that fit the lock set in the corroded but still strong metal door. I pulled the door open and was about to step through when Burns said, "Hold up, ex-cop." He reached inside the doorway and flipped a switch to turn on a spotlight that illuminated a brick courtyard. The inner square was teeming with rats of all shades and sizes. There were hundreds of the rodents disturbed by the sudden flash of intense light. In the meanwhile, Burns found a handful of ping-pong ball-sized rocks that he threw in among the swarming carpet of fur. The rats scattered then. Dozens flooded through the doorway, over my feet and between my ankles. They skittered and screeched loudly, decrying the invasion of their nest.
"Come on, quick," Burns said, hurrying through the doorway. "You know street people can smell it when a door's open somewhere."
We made our way into the spotlit courtyard. Burns pushed the iron door shut and threw the bolt to secure it. I noticed that the hinges were well-oiled for such an ancient entrance.
"You still got that key?"
he asked.
"Yeah."
"It's that green door across the way."
Maybe 15 feet away was another metal door. This one was made of copper, and it turned the green of scum atop a stagnant pond.
"Hurry up and get it open," Burns said. "We don't want no cops seeing the light."
Using the same key, I unlocked the door, pulled it open, and immediately Burns turned off the anti-rat spotlight. He moved around me, turned on another light in the vestibule we'd entered, and closed the door behind us. It was only then that I noticed the acrid, sweet scent of death. It was mild, considering what a human corpse might be. We descended a long stone staircase and came into a room piled with the corpses of at least a dozen souls. It was like my solitary cell, or the cellar in Queens, where assassins meant to bury me, or the underground apartment that Melquoth had gifted for my time on the run. Most of the dead had been that way for quite some time. They were desiccated and shorn of almost all flesh by meat-eating rats.
The topmost corpse, a smallish body, was still decomposing. There were two of the rodents in the hollow of the ribcage, tearing at the rotted flesh. Without thinking, I took out my revolver and shot them. The reports were quite loud, but we were underground and in an abandoned building.
"Are you crazy?"
Burns yelled. It was the only time he'd raised his voice. Looking at the partially exposed skull, I saw a golden upper front tooth gleaming there. "Johanna Mudd," I murmured.
"You know her?"
Burns asked. "Who were they?"
"Kids that caused trouble,"
Burns said.
"Enemies? ODs that would be better not founded?"
"And you carried some of them in here?"
"You gonna shoot me? Like you did them rats?"
he asked. There was no fear in his voice. He was like an old-time condemned Soviet prisoner, sentenced to death, but never told when the bullet to the back of the head might come. "Let's get out of here," I said. Up the stairs we went, and out into the rat's courtyard. We passed through the iron door and secured it. I kept the key. We stood at the entrance a moment or two, maybe experiencing the silent exercise of unconscious prayer for the dead. On each side, in the sheltering holly, dozens of red eyes of rats watched us, willing us to leave.
"What you gonna do with that key?"
Burns asked. "Throw it away," I said. "If they can't get in, maybe somebody'll bring out a body and get caught." At Christopher and Hudson, I gave the remaining cellophane packet and $200 bills to Burns.
"Thanks,"
he said, like a gleeful child.
"I thought you might be lying about another one."
I try not to lie to people who help me. Burns nodded, patting the pocket where he'd deposited the drug. "Did Valance and Pratt work with anybody else?" I asked.
"Not usually. I mean, they had pimps and kids do some pretty bad things, but they was always in charge, if that's what you mean."
"Any other cops?"
"No, never.
Nobody?" The only thing that Burns wanted was to get somewhere where he could inject his escape. But he didn't want to be rude to his benefactor, so he stood there, concentrating.
"One time, they gave me an envelope and told me to meet this guy down by the United Nations."
"What kind of guy?"
"Just a short, prissy faggot."
"White, black?"
"White guy in a pink suit, smelled like roses. I remember because I usually can't put a name to a perfume, but his was definitely roses."
"What was in the envelope?"
"I didn't open it, because Anton gave it to me, and I was only going to get paid when I got back."
"That's all?"
"Why you want to know, anyway? Anton and Yolo is dead, and all the businesses they had is over."
"That was a fresh body in the tomb," I said. "It couldn't have been there more than a few days or so. Somebody who knew the dead cop's business used it to bury that woman."
"Maybe I'll remember more later,"
Burns speculated.
"You know, after I shoot up and then sleep. Sometimes in my dreams I put things together that were far apart before."
"Yeah," I said. "Okay. If you remember something, Hester has my number."
"Maybe we can make some kind of deal?"
"Maybe. If you remember something I need." We stood there a moment or two in silence.
"You gonna get Manny out of that prison?"
Burns asked. "One way or another." I didn't know what the words meant. "Not yet." The junkie took it as his cue to leave. I stood there on the corner. It was nearly 3 a.m. The impact of the mass murder gravesite manifested as a shudder in my chest and forearms. 30. I know I slept because all night long I heard that unnamed prisoner threaten to rape and murder my wife and child. I felt the dank coldness and the crawling, hairy legs of insects over my skin. Men cried out in pain and madness, and there was the continual sound of tramping feet, men pacing in cells only 2.5 steps in length. None of this could have been real because, even though I was in an underground cell, I was not anywhere near the sounds of suffering. There were no rats keening for love or blood or footsteps destined for nowhere. I would have done better.